Well, again, good morning. We are now nearing the end of our series on the four servant songs found in the book of Isaiah. Would you turn there? We will read now from Isaiah 52, beginning in verse 13, down through verse 53, verse 9. If you would remember that this last song is more lengthy than the others, it is comprised of five stanzas of three verses each, three verses in your text. So three of your verses make up one stanza of the song. And we are looking at the fourth stanza this morning. But to sort of get the flow, let us go back to the beginning of the song. Isaiah 52, verse 13. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. As many as were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. The kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. Who hath believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him like a tender plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. He made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. If we were reading these for the first time, they would present to us quite a mystery. We have seen in our study of these four songs this servant. The servant of Yahweh, the servant of Yahweh, or Jehovah, God, however you would translate that word. He was chosen by God. He was foreordained. He was called for a purpose of establishing God's judgment, it is called in that first song, on this earth, what we would call God's kingdom being established. And yet, he's not going to be a rabble-rouser. He will do it by being gentle. He will not bruise, you remember the broken reed. He will not quench the smoking flax. He'll not raise up his voice in the street. He's not a revolutionary. He's not raising an army by physical force to deliver his people. Rather, he is coming as a servant. We learn in the second song that at first he will not seem to be successful. Israel will not be regathered by him, but that will not be his failure. It will be just the door to a bigger victory, a bigger triumph that God says, just to give you Israel is way too small a gift. We sung a moment ago, were the whole realm of nature mine. If everything in this universe was yours, Isaac Watts is saying, it would be a present far too small. And what God Almighty is saying to his servant, as your reward just to give you Israel would be far too small. I'm going to make you a light to the Gentiles. I'm going to send you my salvation, this covenant, to the ends of the earth. And yet we learn that in that rejection of this servant, it involves physical violence. In the third servant song, we learn about him giving his back to the smiters, his beard to those who would pluck out the hair. He does not turn away his face from shame and spitting. This rejection, you see, is a violent rejection. And then we come to this marvelous fourth song. Oh, my. And again, I say it's sort of like taking your binoculars and turning the focus wheel, and suddenly that which was blurry and indistinct, you couldn't really understand it, is now coming into sharper and sharper view. And some of these mysteries, if you had been reading this as a Jew in the Old Testament, scratching your head, we know that happened. We have it with the Ethiopian eunuch, don't we? Scratching his head, asking Philip, who is Isaiah talking about here? Who is this servant? That's a good question to ask. That is the question to ask. And Philip climbs up in the chariot and preaches to him Jesus. From a Christian perspective, here in the New Covenant era, we have no question who this servant was. But if we'd been reading this for the first time, if this was new material being presented to you this morning, you would be scratching your head. What in the world is this all about? For we have this picture in the first stanza of this servant that's going to be exalted and glorified, and yet at the same moment you turn and look at him and his vision is so marred. He's mangled. He's mutilated. He doesn't even look human. And so, wait a minute. What do you mean? How can this be the road to glorification? How can this be a king who is going to reign over all the earth? Kings reign by conquering their enemies, by causing others to suffer and die. And here we see this one who is ordained to be God's king, mangled and mutilated on a Roman torture stake. In the second stanza, in verses 1 through 3 of 53, we see the confession that there was just nothing in him that anyone saw as beautiful, as desirous, as attractive. And the writer of this, suddenly you'll notice that the speaker switches from the first stanza where God is speaking of his servant to now, and I think S. Lewis Johnson hit the nail on the head, calling it the complaint of the primitive preacher of the gospel. Here's somebody who is the messenger bringing the good news of this servant, and he's scratching his head. Why isn't anybody getting this? And yet, notice in verse 2, he has to use the pronoun we. When we saw him, there was no beauty in him that we should desire him. There was once upon a time he didn't get it either. He's basically complaining, why aren't others seeing this thing? Why don't they get this message? Why don't they see the might and the arm of God in this one who is mangled and mutilated? But he must confess that there was a time he didn't get it either. And we see the problem is that they saw this one being obviously judged, and they assumed in the last part of verse 3, he was being judged by God. And they were partially right, weren't they? This was a judgment from God. And the explanation for why is this innocent man, this servant of Yahweh, why is he suffering? In the next stanza, in stanza 3, we get the explanation. And notice, we call the death of Jesus Christ on the cross penal substitution. Penal having to do with justice, the penalty of sin. Substitution that someone else is bearing the just penalty. Okay, at the heart, there's a lot of things going on in the cross of Jesus Christ, but that's the heart. That's the heart of hearts of the cross, penal substitution. And you see it expressed in this third stanza seven different ways. I don't know how you can say it. I don't know how there could be any. Trust me, you read liberal scholars and they come with all kinds of theories about what was going on here. I don't know how you can say it any plainer, any clearer. In seven different ways, in two verses, the writer expresses this. Notice verse 4. Surely he has borne our griefs. He's bearing our griefs. Secondly, he's carrying, like the lamb, the scapegoat, carrying away their sin in the wood. He's carrying our sorrows. In verse 5, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. The chastisement of our peace. In other words, the chastisement necessary to restore peace for us is upon him. And with his stripes, we are healed. And finally, all we, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to our own way, and the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. Seven times the notion of substitution is being expressed here with the idea that he is bearing the penalty. Notice the different expressions that so graphically illustrate our sin, this wickedness. All these different ways of looking at what we have done and the penalty being laid upon him. Now we come to the fourth stanza. And you say, well, preacher, what else is there to say? Well, trust me, I always have something else to say. Okay. And that's because Isaiah has something else to say. The prophecy has more to say. Because you see, if you were reading this for the first time, you still got this puzzle. You still have this question in your mind. Why and how is this happening exactly? Okay, I get it. I get it. Here's an innocent man who is suffering the penalty for the crimes of others. But how exactly did that work? I mean, was this accidental? Was it tragic? You know, circumstances got out of control. I remember, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm a child of the 60s. So, the musical back then, which is sort of like, you know, Jesus was this peaceful hippie type guru, came into town, and events just spun out of control, and all of a sudden he winds up being martyred. Is that what happened? Was it simply accidental? Was it just a tragic thing that occurred at the hands of wicked men? Is that what happened? Or was he dragged there? Was he made to go? Was this a situation like we used to get those letters in the mail in the 60s? Your friends and neighbors at the Selective Service have selected you to represent them in the United States Armed Forces, right? Some of you got that letter, I'm sure. Yeah, you got picked out to go to Vietnam. Is that what happened? Did he get drafted? How did this all happen? And now we come to this fourth stanza, with three verses. And the three verses in our text, from verses 7 down through 9, are detailing to us the three phases of how this is going to happen, how it's going to work. Verse 7, will detail the servant's sentencing. Verse 8 will detail the servant's execution. And verse 9 will detail the servant's burial. Okay? His sentencing, his judgment, his death, and his burial. That is what is before us in these three verses that comprise the fourth stanza of this prophecy. Notice, as we now look at the servant's sentencing in verse 7, we notice by reading that entire verse that he is being brought before someone. Notice he is brought as a lamb to the slaughter. He's being produced. He's being presented as in a court of justice. Someone here is clearly his accusers. Someone is his judge. Someone is his oppressors. And to oppress someone speaks of being, generally, it's the idea of being squeezed, compacted. And it's used in many ways, especially in the Old Testament of the, for instance, Israel being oppressed by their taskmasters in the land of Egypt. So it carries with it the idea of not only being squeezed and pressured, but the idea of being subject to cruel treatment, wicked, violent treatment at the hands of someone who is your taskmaster. And of course, to us, we immediately think of the beating, the scourging, the mockery that he received even before he was sentenced to death. The second verb here is that he was afflicted. Notice he was oppressed and he was afflicted. And of course, that to us seems to indicate almost the same thing, just saying the same thing in two different ways, but it's really not in the Hebrew. You'll notice that the second verb in particular is passive. In other words, this is something being done to him. But many scholars of Hebrew, and I'm not one of them, but I can read what they say that this ought to be rendered in what is called the reflexive. Now, I'm sure many of you are up to date on that. You were awake that day in eighth grade grammar when you talked about reflexive verbs. But the idea is, in a reflexive passive, that it's not just being done to you, but you are allowing it to be done to you. The best men I have read, that's how they say it ought to be translated here. That it is talking about the fact that he is allowing. In other words, he's being oppressed and he's allowing it to happen. He is submitting himself to it. He is humbling himself to this oppression. And that is being borne out in the two comparisons that are being made here in this verse. Notice the first comparison is that what is happening, how he is acting is like a lamb that is being brought to the slaughter, and as a sheep, which is not exactly the same as a lamb, but same genre of animal, a sheep who is being brought to the shearers. Okay? Notice those two comparisons. Now, when we see the word lamb, the idea we jump to is that of the lamb being slain and so forth, sacrifice. But notice the two aspects of a lamb and a sheep that are being indicated here. In both cases is their submission, their silent submission. You see it? And that would then throw fire on the argument that indeed what is being expressed here is Christ is being oppressed, and yet he is bowing to it. He is submitting to it in silence. He is receiving it. He is humbling himself to be the sin bearer. You get the sense of it? And notice that in one case, the silence of the lamb is a silence of ignorance. You get that? I mean, the lamb has no clue what's coming. I mean, he may think he's the center of attention. He's hot stuff, right up to the point they slit his throat. I mean, he has no clue that he is about to be sacrificed. So the silence of the lambs is a silence of ignorance. Secondly, the silence of the sheep that is being shorn is a silence of nature. So one of the strange things about having raised sheep is I saw this in person. Number one, my dad and I tried to shear one of our ewes. We decided it's too much money to pay 50 cents to these shearing crews that would come through North Texas and shear sheep. 50 cents a head, I mean, extortion. So we decided we can borrow a set of shearers from a nearby ag teacher and we can shear our sheep ourselves. Wrong. After about an hour of wrestling this ewe out in the front yard, trying to hold the thing down, try to shear it, what we wound up with was a bloody mess. Not only did it look like a poodle with a bad haircut, it was cut to ribbons. Those shears will cut right through the skin. And so we have labored, and after we got through, we decided 50 cents per head is pretty good. Those guys, the best ones I ever saw, came through, and they averaged, I had about 50 sheep for them to shear. They averaged 3 minutes a head. There were three guys. One guy that was catching them, one guy that was doing the shearing, one guy that was sacking the wool. 3 minutes a head, they could shear a sheep. I mean, it's just as fast as they can go. Because they knew exactly how to handle the sheep. The old ewes that fought us tooth and nail, they would get their hands on it and that thing just go, look like it's been drugged. I mean, just plop. And I mean, they're throwing this thing, and this guy's going like this, and throw it back the other way, and like this, and the sheep just laying there, just letting them, just surrendering to their hands. That is something about the nature of a sheep that when it thinks it's useless to resist, it just gives up. And so notice, in one case, we have the silence of ignorance of the lamb that's about to be slaughtered. In this case, we have simply the sheep by nature tends to surrender. But notice that in our case, it is not that. And that is the point that Isaiah is making here. Though he is innocent, he makes absolutely no protest. He is utterly silent before his accusers, so silent that they are astounded by it. I can give you texts where the Jews are astounded by his silence, Herod astounded by his silence, and finally Pilate marveling that he didn't defend himself. Why? Because you talk about what a sheep is by nature, what are you by nature? You're a complainer, a whiner, and especially when you're being unjustly treated. Well, maybe I'm just telling you how I am, but I suspect you go to prison and there's nobody there that is silent. Everybody there should be out in their mind. They've been framed. Their rat partner, that's what they call them. You know, your partner ratted on you, and that's why I'm here. They're free. I'm here in prison because they ratted on me. They did the same thing I did. I ought to be free like them. Everybody's innocent. Everybody, according to them, ought to be out there on the street. Nobody is silent, and especially the man who's there unjustly. I mean, we can generally sometimes bite our tongue, gut our way through being, you know, punished for what we did, but oh my, you let me be punished for what I didn't do? And out my mouth comes all kinds of complaint. Unfair, unjust. How dare you? I demand, I deserve better treatment than this. You know you, you know man. And here we see this marvelous silence on the part of this servant of Yahweh, that he utterly refuses to speak a word in his defense, to protest the treatment that he's receiving, to justify himself in any way. He is fully bowing, surrendering to what is being done to him. And here echoes in our ears that another hymn, apparently, another song in Philippians chapter 2, where he humbled himself, says Paul, even to the death of the cross. And that humility is exhibited by his silence. This is the point, that unlike the sacrifices that were offered under the law, animal sacrifices, his sacrifice was voluntary. I want to read you a section out of Alec Motyer's commentary. To me, it's the best contemporary commentary on Isaiah, and I've benefited much from studying it. I know you probably never heard the name, Alec Motyer, but if you're studying Isaiah, you need to get to know this name. But anyway, here's what he says right here. He says, Isaiah has been expressing the truth of the servant's death in the accepted terminology of sin-bearing. You agree? That's what he's been talking about. And now he introduces and indeed drives home a new thought. Not that the servant did not deserve to die. He's already done that in verses 4 and 6. But that he did not deserve to die, and yet he was willing to do so. In a word, the fatal flaw in existing substitutionary procedures, that is, under the law of Moses, was exposed and met in one stroke. For the point where animal substitution failed was also the very point where sin is the most serious. Sin as a failure need be no more than a pity. Sin as a moral defect is distressing, but it leaves it arguable that what cannot be helped, therefore cannot be blameworthy. But sin as willfulness is the very thing God cannot overlook. It is the very heart of our sinfulness that we sin because we want to. And he quotes here, we will not have that man. We will not have that man reign over us. And he goes on to say, because of this, no animal can do any more than just picture substitution. Only a person can substitute for a person. Only a consenting will can substitute for a rebellious will. The servant indeed fulfills the stated requirements for a substitute. He identified with sinners in the condemnation. He was without the stain of our sin. He was acceptable to the holy God. But he also adds what no other did or could, the will to accept and submit to the substitute's position. Oh my, that's well stated. That's it. And I've tried to say the same thing before, not as eloquently as that. But the idea that the animal substitute never knew what was coming, never knew what was hitting. Jesus knew from the beginning of his ministry, as he said over and over again, we must go to Jerusalem. I'll be handed into the hands of the priests and the chief priests and the rulers. I'll be scourged and I will be crucified, but I'll be raised again the third day. He knowingly goes to the cross. It is interesting, isn't it, in Hebrews 10, verse 7, where you have the very first words. I'm sure some of you mothers expecting new babies here, you're always interested in the first words that they will say. And strangely enough, we have the words in Hebrews 10, verse 7, the first words that were ever uttered by the Son of God as he came into this world. It's before he's being born in Bethlehem. And what does he say? It is written in the books of me. I come to what? To do thy will. It's what we hear in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not my will, but thy will be done. That's what no animal could ever do. That's what only the Son of God can do in offering himself. No other of us qualified to be the substitute. All others of us tainted, stained with sin. Here is the holy, spotless Lamb of God, the only sacrifice that would have been acceptable to God the Father, coming to surrender to the will of his Father. And so now we have a little bit more light shown on this amazing spectacle. How is it that this one can take our place? How is it that he's there? What put him there? Yes, in one sense, it's the hands of wicked men. But in a very real sense, he goes there because it is the will of his Father to die for sinners. Secondly, we have the second stage in verse 8, and that's his execution. The phrase in Hebrew that he was taken from prison and from judgment is a very difficult phrase, and I'm going to just cut to the chase here. The words literally mean he was taken without restraint and without justice. I think the way we would put it in our day, and we would refer to the Fifth Amendment of our federal constitution, that he was being denied due process. Due process under the law is the idea that you will get a fair, just hearing. And so what is being expressed here in verse 8 is that he is utterly being denied what we call due process. And the next phrase is very difficult. And the Hebrew here, there's a lot of different ways to express this. It talks about his generation, his who shall declare his generation or his generation declaring. The best way, I think, to put it, the word generation in Hebrew means descendants. But this word typically does not mean descendants. That's another word. The other word, zerah, means seed, and it's going to be used down here in verse 10. We'll get to it eventually. But the word that's here translated descendants typically means your contemporaries. The word implies a circle. And so if I say to you in a figurative way, who is in your circle? Well, you understand what I'm saying, don't you? In other words, these are my peers. These are my contemporaries. These are my friends, my associates. And so a good way of thinking of this is that this generation that is here speaking is his contemporary, and that they are being silent in his defense. I think I may be wrong. I think that is the clearest, closest explanation I can give you to what is being said here. Because notice it's talking about the unfairness from a human's perspective of what is happening to him. Justice is not being upheld. Justice is being swept under the rug. You do understand that. He's being denied due process. And what it is saying that none of his contemporaries speak up in his defense because none of his contemporaries see what is here in the last part, that he's being stricken for the transgression of his people. Nobody gets it. That's what it's saying. In other words, we asked ourselves, well, where was his friends in the middle of this? Well, where were they? They were hiding. I mean, the prophecy said, smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. And guess what? The sheep scattered, didn't they? They went in the hole. They went in the ground. They went undercover. His closest confederates. Peter, the only one that even makes a contempt, stands there and swears an oath and denies him, threatened by a little maiden of all things. You understand? Anyone who would have spoken up in his favor have disappeared completely. There is not one voice speaking up for his innocence. There is in the Jewish tradition, I'm quoting here Josephus and then a little later the Talmud. There's a Jewish tradition that when someone was being accused of blasphemy, and therefore, and remember that was the crime Jesus was charged with by the Jews, that you were to take 40 days before you could execute that person, you sent out word for 40 days for anybody to come forth with a good word to say about him. Someone who would come forth out of the shadows and defend him. Now, we know that didn't happen. The Jews conveniently overlooked the demands of their own law here, obviously, and they did that by turning him over to Pilate for execution. So they could say, you know, our hands are clean. We didn't kill him. The Romans killed him. Okay? And so they did not go through this, but notice that many commentators feel like that's what this verse is making reference to. That here is the demand to search for someone who would come forth and give a good word for this condemned criminal that's about to be put to death by your hands, and that simply was not done. All we do know is in the case of our Lord, there were no such voices raised. And then it tells us, and this is the one thing we do know, he was cut off. Cut off. Usually it means violently severed, to sever something from something. It's the word used when Solomon said, the baby, cut that baby in two. Sever it in half. It's the word they use when they cut down a tree. It's a word expressing violence and to cut something off from something. And when you say he was cut off from what? The land of the living. What you are expressing is that he was put to death. That's obvious a little later in the prophecy in verse, the next verse, in fact, talks about his death. But it's a poetic way because in the Jewish mind, there's two realms. There's the realm of the living. There's the realm of the dead, Sheol, what the Greeks called Hades, translated hell oftentimes. And so he's being severed from the land of the living. It is a poetic way of saying he was put to death. And then the third verse of this fourth stanza is found in verse 9, and it speaks of his burial. I realize that we all know that the gospel is summed up by the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, but most of us don't give a lot of thought to the middle word there, the burial. What in the world, why is that important? But here we find this strange statement, and he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. And at first glance, especially if you're reading out of the King James, you think, well, wait a minute, the prophecy got it backwards. Because this says he made his grave with the wicked and he was with the rich in his death. Should have been the other way around. He made his grave with the rich and he was with the wicked in his death. Right? But again, it comes back to how you translate this. And the word he made, again being rendered in an active voice, him doing something, should be understood in a passive sense. He was assigned. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, but was with the rich in his death. That's the sense of thing. In other words, here we come to the last riddle, at least the last one for now. The last one you're going to have to worry about this morning, this afternoon. Okay? Don't have to do any more hard thinking. Here's your last riddle. And we've had riddles all the way through this. How is it that this exalted, glorified servant is this mangled, mutilated form over here on a tree? What does that mean? How in the world? What? And then how is it that this one who is God's approved, chosen servant can be the sin bearer of the world? We've just had that saw for us. But now we come to the third riddle. And it is so perplexing. In fact, some of you may have read of Kyle and Dalish, their Old Testament commentaries, standard work. Everybody's got it. I don't have it, but anyway. Delish, in his comment on this verse, says, this is so confusing in the Hebrew that it took the fulfillment for us to understand it. In other words, this is something you're just not going to figure out on your own until it happens. And of course, you say, well, what happened? What happened when Christ died? The most confused. What do you normally have happen when somebody is executed on a cross? These are Roman criminals. This is a torture stake. It usually takes days for them to die. And when they die, they just leave them up there and let the birds of the air pick the bones clean. And if they are buried at all, they're just piled into a heap of bones with other criminals who have died, burned, and then taken down to the garbage heap, which in Jerusalem was Gehenna, that fire that was never quenched down there in the gully. That's what you do with people who are being condemned as criminals. The last thing on earth that you would expect is for a rich man, and we have the account in all four Gospels. I'm not going to take the time to read it. We have the account in all four Gospels of a rich man named Joseph of Arimathea. He's not even from Jerusalem, but he's a member of the Sanhedrin. This guy's a big wig. He would be like a senator in our system of government. Out of the shadows comes this man who goes to Pilate asking for the body of Jesus. Number one, what a shock, what a surprise that a man of his standing, his stature, whom Pilate would know, this guy's an important dude. And that's probably the only reason he got the request that he asked for. Here's an important Jew asking for the body and takes it and buries it in a sepulcher that he has hewn out of the rock there. Do you understand that most people are just going to be buried like you and me in the ground? Only the kings, only the most noble of men were buried in the sepulchers. The most important people in the city are buried in what we would call a mausoleum. I won't go through the process, but typically their bones, after about a year, they'd come in there and gather them up, put them in a little bone box so they could bury other members of the family in this same tomb. Here is a tomb that this man from Arimathea dug for himself in Jerusalem. It's never been used. It's a new sepulcher, meaning unused. And he comes and asks Pilate for the body of Jesus, this criminal who has just been tortured on a cross, and takes it and buries it in his own tomb that he's never used. And in other words, you start thinking about the providence here. He's from Arimathea. Why is he building a sepulcher in Jerusalem? Why is he digging this sepulcher near to the place where Jesus is crucified, as the gospel record tells us? And all of it to show what is being shown here, so that when this happens, you see, the point of this prophecy, it is so strange, it is so puzzling, that when it transpires, you say, okay, now I see. And it means he must be the servant of Yahweh. This is the identifying feature. Oh, we've had a bunch of them, but this is sort of the final thing. There's no one else that's going to be crucified like a criminal and then turn around and given the burial of a king. That's just not how it happens. And yet that is precisely how it happened in Jesus' case. Why? Why would he be buried in such an honorable fashion? And the last part of the verse tells us, because there was no deceit. There's no violence, no deceit in his mouth. He is the holy Son of God, and his humiliation is now over. This is the first step towards the throne. We don't think of your burial necessarily being a step up to glory, but in the case of Jesus Christ, his burial, the manner of his internment, is showing that it's finished. His work of humiliation, of bowing and bearing the sins of his people, is now over, finished, and he is on his way to the top. God, his Father, will not allow him to be humiliated anymore. He has suffered unto death, and now it's all up, up, up. One final mystery here, and I'm not sure I can solve this for you, is the word death in this verse is plural. His deaths. And it's puzzled scholars for centuries. Why would you speak of the deaths, plural, of Christ? Job, however, in Job 17, verse 1, you can look it up for yourself, that word death that's used there, he's sort of saying God is hounding me to the grave or to death, is also plural. So it was not an unknown figure of speech. And some have suggested it only seems strange to us. It would not have seemed strange to them. Some have said it's a plural of extension. That means it's sort of like the graveyard. It's not just one grave, it's a bunch of graves. Okay? Others have said that is a plural of majesty. There is a usage of it in the book of 2 Kings where it's being applied to the death of a king. That the king's death is like death's. In other words, it's speaking of the bigness of the death. Words fail me. But I think probably the thing closest to the truth is that it is a plural of intensity. That it speaks of the nature of Christ's death and how it transcends any other. It is the superior death, the death of all deaths. Because this is the death, number one, of the Son of God. This is the death of God's servant. Secondly, in Christ's death, there were two deaths. Because Christ not only experienced what we call physical death and yielded up his body to the Father, but he also experienced what we call spiritual death. The best way to define it is to be cut off from your Father. And we just read the words out of Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you silent? Here is one who has always known his Father's smile of approval, now utterly bereft and devoid of the sense of his Father's pleasure. And it's a mystery, because at the very moment he was devoid of that sense of pleasing his Father, he was pleasing his Father. Okay, go figure. Or maybe it expresses more than perhaps even Isaiah knew, because in his death, if you're a Christian this morning, you died. That is what Paul expounds on in several places in the New Testament, that in his death, we died. I am crucified with Christ, right? Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. There's this sense that those who follow him in discipleship have indeed experienced that death. They have, in the words of Jesus, taken up the cross and followed him. To be his disciple, they have died. They've died to the world. Paul will say that in Galatians 6, by this cross I glory in, by whom the world is crucified unto me, and I unto the world. I died to the world in the cross of Jesus Christ. We die to the world. We die to self. We die to our human family. We die to our human possessions and privilege. And do you understand? To follow Christ. That's why we have baptism, by the way. Because you're coming there to die. I no longer live. It's not me anymore. It's Christ living in me. That's the nature of Christianity. And so perhaps that's it. I don't know. Can't be sure. Can't be certain. But an amazing expression. All right. Lord willing, next week we shall finish this series with the results. The results of the servant's suffering. Stay tuned. Come back. Let's pray. Father, thank you for one like this, who would stoop, who would bow, who would humble himself to such a death as this. From a human side, to be hated without cause, no reason, to be bereft of judgment, due process, and yet all because it was your will that sin be laid on him. Our sin. My sin. Lord, may this touch the deepest chords of our hearts, the deepest strands of our thinking. May we be moved to express in the words we sang earlier, love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all. May we be moved to more than sing, to do, to act, to hate sin, because here we see vividly portrayed the wickedness of sin as it is being borne by our substitute, the holy, righteous Son of God. May we never underestimate its wickedness. And may we forever have a heart of gratitude and praise and thanksgiving for what you've done for us through Christ. May we stand amazed in the presence of Jesus the Nazarene. Father, if there's one outside of the kingdom, I pray that this might be the day that they bow, that they surrender to the rule of Jesus Christ. That, Lord, that prophecy that he would bring forth your judgment, your kingdom in this world, that might be fulfilled even partially this day, as we see with our own eyes others coming to bow to his rule. May you do it for his sake. Give him the glory. We pray in his name. Amen.